So, and the other thing is that the shir today is Le'iloi Nishmas, my grandfather, my father's father, Avram Abba ben Pinchas. Today was his yahrzeit. As far as my recollection goes, he died in 1980. You could disagree with me if you think I'm wrong. I think I'm right. And so the Torah we learned should be Le'iloi Nishmas. So we were, I think, all of the grandchildren. My father's an only child, so he had us, and we were all very close to him. And he was the grandfather who would spoil all of his grandchildren as much as he possibly could, and as much as my parents would let him. But that's the kind of person that he was. And when I did the math in my head and realized it was so long ago, so I was a little surprised that it was really that long. But then now again, I realize my wife never met him, my children obviously never met him, and so I guess it has been a while. So let us begin. What we're going to talk about today is, once again, we're going to talk about Nadu Navihu. I really have one very small thing I want to say, and it would only take me 3 minutes, but I decided that would not be right, so I'll waste like 57 minutes of your time, and then we'll get to the 3 minutes towards the end. But I know sometimes these things have to be built up properly in order to get to the point. And look, the truth is, I've spoken about them many times. This is not the first time, the second time, the third time. And so you say, how much can you say about them? So I think that there's a couple of things to put together, and I'm not convinced people have put together what I'm trying to do today. So there could be a chiddush here as well. So let us begin. Vayichu bnei Aharon, Nadav Avihu, and you've noticed, of course, where I'm starting in Perek Yud. I'm skipping the whole introduction, which is probably not fair. Vayichu bnei Aharon, Nadav Avihu, ish machtato, v'yitnu bahen esh v'yisimu alei ktoret, v'yakrivu lifnei Hashem esh zara asher lo tziva otam. Now, the first question that I have is, are they working together or are they working separately? Because I know that there are a lot of times in the Chumash that we seem to work and we see people as tandems, whether we should or shouldn't. But there are a number of times, especially when they're brothers, we see them as working from the same motivation, doing the same thing. And I'm just raising the question, are they necessarily coming from the same point? And the obvious answer to that would be yes. But if I'm asking the question, so then at least maybe I give you a little bit of pause to at least consider that question. We should note, Vayichu is in plural, Vayichu bnei Aharon, Nadav Avihu, ish machtato, which means that they are each doing it, but are they each doing it independently? Vayinu bahem esh v'yisimu alei ktoret, Vayikrivu lifnei Hashem ish zara asher lo tziva otam. The response, nonetheless, is catastrophic. Vateitzei esh min lifnei Hashem, Vatochalotam, v'yamotu lifnei Hashem. And a fire comes out from in front of God and swallows and consumes them, and they die in front of God. Now, if we were to pause there, and I don't want to pause there so much because I do want to read the next pasuk, but if we're going to pause there, we're left with somewhat befuddled because we don't know exactly what it is that was wrong or what it is that was deserving of this type of a response. If we'll read it one more time and a little bit slower, Vayichu b'nei Aharon, Nadav Avihu, ish machtato. Again, each one takes the machat. V'yitnu bahem esh. They place fire. And until this point, we don't know what's wrong. V'yisimu lektoret. And they put the incense there. And one of the questions I'm going to ask is, okay, why did they do this? Why Ktoret? What is their motivation? Were they right? Were they wrong? I know it's very funny to ask if they're right because of the disastrous results, but nonetheless, I'm going to ask that question. Were they right? V'yakrivu lifnei Hashem esh zara. Now, our first problem is that word zara. Esh zara sounds a little bit to us like avodah zara. There's something that sounds wrong about that. Esh zara, asher lo tziva otam, which they were not commanded. So are those the same things? Which means, is esh zara because asher lo tziva otam? Or is this Eish Zara because it was something which is fundamentally wrong? And when we get to Asher Lo Tziva Otam, then we're left with another point. Is this really what we would call a Simon Says problem? Which means, did they do the right thing? Oh, but you know, God didn't say it, didn't say that you should do it, so therefore it's wrong. And you will realize that would be very disappointing if that were the entire issue. And then, Vateitzei Eish Lefnei Hashem V'tachal Otam. And as bizarre as my question on that is going to be, is that a good thing or a bad thing? But obviously you'll say that's a bad thing. V'yamotu Lefnei Hashem. And they died in front of God. And the thing which disturbs me in terms of saying that this is just a terrible thing. Well, death is bad. I mean, that we all realize. But nonetheless, they're described as the Eishes Milifnei Hashem and Vayamutu Lifnei Hashem. And this Lifnei Hashemness, this being in front of God, being in God's proximity, there is something about that which actually sounds very good. The whole point of the Mishkan is for the Shekhinah to be there, for God's presence to be there, to have proximity with God. So therefore you can say, wow, these people succeeded beyond imagination in terms of being together with God. I mean, okay, we'll pause there for a moment. At various times in Tanakh, Nadav and Avihu are mentioned, and when they are mentioned, inevitably this point of being Lifnei Hashem is going to come back and be mentioned again. If you look at source number 9, Vayamat Nadav Avihu Lifnei Hashem. Okay, that part sounded good. Be'akravam Eish Zara Lifnei Hashem. So again, this Lifnei Hashemness is something which we find interesting. Again, in source number 10, Vayamat Nadav Avihu Be'akravam Eish Zara Lifnei Hashem. So that way it sounded bad. But again, it's this Lifnei Hashem which intrigues us. 11 is going to actually open the door for one of the interpretations. V'yamat nadu aviyu Lifnei Avihim. You thought it was going to be Lifnei Hashem, but it's not. Lifnei Avihim Uvanim Lohayu Lahem. Which means when we deal with chronological records, normally it has he begat, he begat, he begat. So over here, they died before their father, which is not the natural order, and they did not have children afterwards. V'chanu Elazar v'Tamar, and therefore these others, almost by default, ended up taking over. So again, we see these various examples, and we keep on coming back to this Lifnei Hashem, which at least, I'll say it again, leaves us with this question. Right? Source number 9 also said, Uvanim lo hayu lahem. They did not have children, which again, that's going to really open up this possible Pandora's box, or this Pandora's box with the possible interpretations of what it is that was wrong in terms of their behavior. Now, to pause there for a moment, going back to the first source, that we see that they die. We're not sure what to do because of Lifnei Hashem. And the truth is, there's something else over here that we do really need to pay attention to, and that's what happened before this, but I'm conveniently ignoring it. Pasuk Gimel, Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, Hu Asher Diber Hashem. This is what God referred to Lamor saying, Bikrovai Ekadesh. Now, I don't know how to translate this. V'al Pnei Kol Ha'am Ekabed, V'idom Aaron. So the English translation, which I really randomly chose, through those near to me, I show myself holy and gain glory before all the people. Aaron was silent. So Rashi tells us how to read this. And Rashi spins this in a way where if, again, I apologize for this formulation. If Rashi is right, then almost all the other interpretations we're going to see today are going to be superfluous. Because we're going to find lots and lots and lots of opinions that end up building a conspiracy. The conspiracy is blaming them because they must have done something which is terrible. Why must be something terrible? Because look at the results. And if they died, so there must be a cause for their death, and therefore somebody must be responsible. Now, the predominant view is that the ones responsible were obviously Nadav and Avihu. There's another view that the one responsible is Aaron, and that this goes back to Aaron's guilt in terms of, and for that matter, perhaps Aaron's punishment in terms of his sin of the golden calf, which, by the way, is going to be very clearly in the background of everything that we're studying today as well. because to a great extent, one can argue, especially according to Rashi, that the whole idea of having a Mishkan is there in order to create healing after there was the sin of the golden calf, and therefore the presence of God perhaps was not with them, and therefore there was not this Lifnei Hashemness. We had Lifnei Hashem when we stood by Mount Sinai, and it became too intense for us. And we said to Moshe, no, this is too much. And Moshe, you deal with this. And Moshe goes and deals with it. But Moshe says, no, no, no. If you let God speak to you, you're not going to sin. Well, we didn't let God speak to us, and we sinned. What sin did we do? We ended up doing the golden calf. And afterwards, we don't have the same Lifnei Hashemness. I'm sorry for using this as an English phrase. We lack this proximity to God. And now the building of the Mishkan is to recreate this closeness with God. And but it's as if saying, well, that's a little bit too intense, this closeness, which means we didn't want it to be that intense. But nonetheless, when I ask this question, is this a success or is this a failure? All of us would start off by saying, no, this is a failure because they died. Death is not what we wanted over here. But nonetheless, we keep coming back to this issue of Lifnei Hashem, which I don't want you to ignore. If we go back now and try all over again, Rashi says, Hu Asher Diber. This is what God said. Now, by the way, that is completely intriguing. What does Moshe mean by that? That God really said this was going to happen? So Rashi says, yeah. Heichan Diber. Where did he say this? V'no adati shama Lifnei Yisrael v'nikdash b'chvodi. And he quotes a verse back in Shmot Kaf Tet. Al tikri bichvodi ela bimechubadai. Amr lo Moshe la Aaron. Moshe says to Aaron, Aaron achi, my brother, yodea hayiti sheyit kadesh habayit b'miyodav shel makom. I knew that this house was going to be sanctified by those who are special, by those who are close and known to the Holy One, blessed be. It's interesting to use the word makom because we're creating kedushat makom. We're creating holiness of space. V'hayiti savur, and Moshe says, I thought, o bi o b'cha, it was either me or you. Achshav ro'eh ani shehem gedolim mimeni u'mimcha, and now I see that they are in fact greater than me or you. Now this is a frightening commentary by Rashi, and again, it could be, in fact, what Moshe said. If this is the case, then Moshe seems to be saying, by the way, I'm not signing off on this 100%. He seems to be saying, yeah, I knew that this day was going to come, and I knew that one of us was going to die. I thought it was me or you. And yet Moshe just marches ahead and doesn't say a word about this. And oh, look at that. It turned out to be Nadav Aviv. They were even greater. They're the ones that God took on this day. I mean, that is a frightening commentary. I mean, the other thing is, did God really say it? If I wanted to, I could be even a little meaner and say, does Rashi really mean that God said this? Because Rashi's not 100% sold on this, although it may depend on how you read the Rashi. The reason I say that, because he tells us, look in Shemot Perek Kaf Tet. Now, someplace in the next 15 pages or so, I have Shemot Perek Kaf Tet, and I want you to look actually at what the Pasuk says and what Rashi says about it, because I'll say it again, I don't think that Rashi is 100% sold on this interpretation, and if he is, I know that it sounds like I'm backing up, if he is, he's not saying it as necessarily what he had understood right away. If we look over here in Source 23, and so on. So we want a little context. This is the normative, normal, daily service that will be done once we have a Mishkan. Right, this is it. It doesn't get more basic than this. The keves in the morning, the keves in the afternoon. Katit revahin, and so on. Again, the normal tamid shel shachar, the tamid shel bein arbayim, which it actually will say very soon, Pasuk Membet, Olat Tamid L'Dorotechem, this will be the burnt offering which will be offered on a daily basis, Petach O Amoed Lifnei Hashem, by the way, notice Lifnei Hashem, and one of the things I want you to note, though, is that where is Lifnei Hashem? Is that a concept or is that a place? Over here, it considers Lifnei Hashem Petach O Amoed, which may be quite important. I show Iva Edlachem Sham, L'daber Edlach Hashem. This is where I'm going to communicate to Moshe from the Petach O Amoed. I will make myself known to the children of Israel. And that's where those words come up. And I will be sanctified by those who are to be honored, if you will. If we'll just finish this part up, and I will make this Ohamoed, I'll make this Mishkan a place which will be holy, and the altar, I'm going to sanctify them to serve me, and my Shekhinah, my presence, will come in the Jewish people, which means, and I will be a God for them, which means that the relationship is healed. Whatever bad happened by the sin of the golden calf, it's healed over here. And yes, I am very much going in a Rashi direction. But yud'u, and then they'll know, ki ani Hashem Elokeich Eloheihem asher hotzeiti otam eretz Yisrael l'shachni b'tocham. I took them out in order for my spirit to be within them. Ani Hashem Eloheihem. And therefore, he's saying, yeah, everything's going to be healed. You're going to build the Mishkan. I'm going to dwell within the Jewish people. I'm going to dwell within this Mishkan. And that's where Rashi said, oh, v'nikdash b'chvodi. So let's skip 24 and go straight to 25. Rashi, teshishrei shchinati bo, b'chvodi, my honor, that my presence will be there. U'midrash agada, and there's a midrash that says, al tikre, don't say b'chvodi, ela b'chvodai, those who honor me, as it were, b'muchubadim shali, the important ones to me. Kan ramazlo. So that's what I'm saying, is Rashi in on this completely? He called it a remez. What's a remez? It's a hint. Kan ramazlo mitat b'nei Aaron b'yom hakamato. Here God hinted. So therefore, what Rashi seems to be saying is that when God said it, Moshe did not understand it. Kan ramazlo mitat b'nei Aaron b'yom hakamato. But it's only in retrospect, when it happened, that he goes back and he starts thinking, which means it's a retrospective, because it's a remez, it was a hint, and it sounds as if, I know I'm reading into this a bit, but it sounds as if he's saying that he understood it only post facto. By the way, there are other approaches to this, because one of the things you have to ask, hold it, is that really pshat over here? Is this really what the verse said? If you look at source 24, the Midrash Agadah says, "V'nikdash b'chodi zemase nadav aviyu." Oh, this talks on nadav aviyu. Shakadosh baruch hu midakdei kimat tzadikim kechot asara yoter mikol adam. Now, that's not what you thought Rashi said. Let me translate. Because God is more stringent when it comes to his treatment of the righteous than he is with other people. Which means what the Midrash over here is saying is that what identifies them as being righteous, the fact that God treated them so strictly. Which means it's only, let me try that again. Moshe realizes, or perhaps this is what Moshe hears God saying, or perhaps as Midrash says what God is saying, is that, yes, this is talking about Nadav Avihu. And Nadav Avihu got punished for what they did, even though somebody else who was not as righteous would not have been punished. Which means, what did they do so badly? They didn't do anything so badly. They did something very minor. It was a minor infraction. But the very fact that God was so strict with them, that's what shows that they were so holy. That's what this Midrash says. If you look at the Rashbam, it goes in a slightly different direction. V'nikdash b'chvodi. My glory, I will sanctify you with my glory. She'ener el Yisrael. I will become seen, manifest, understood by Israel. Kishiyu kama mishkan, when the mishkan is built. V'tavo esh shamala, and the fire will come from heaven. V'tochalat korbanot, and it's going to swallow up the offerings, consume the offerings. Tidichtiv b'yom ha-shmini, as it said in Parshat Shmini, our Parsha, ki ha-yom ha-shem nir aleichem. That's what Moshe said right away to Aaron, because today God is going to appear. V'ketuv v'yira kvod Hashem al kol ha-am v'tetzei esh milafnei Hashem v'tochal et ha-olah. Now this is fascinating, because if a fire comes out and swallows the olah, again, just look at source, do we want 26? But yeah, we really wanted the end as well. I don't think I included that. And God said, at the end of verse 4, Ki hayom Hashem nira aleichem. What happened at the very end of that section? At the very end of the section, Moshe and Aaron come pray, and they bless the people, and a fire comes out and consumes the altar, and hits the altar, and then consumes this offering. So it's fascinating, because the Rashbam is saying, yeah, God says, I will appear. How does God appear? A fire comes out of heaven. What happens happens when the fire comes out of heaven? It eats the olah. But what's interesting about the Rashbam's commentary, at least over here, noticed, opposed to Rashi, opposed to that Midrash, he does connect this with Yom HaShmini, but he just left one thing out. What did he leave out? Any connection with Nadav and Aviyu. Although, don't draw any conclusions yet from the Rashbam, because he's far more interesting than I've led on so far, and he has far more to say about this. So, let's try to recap for a moment. If we were to take Rashi seriously, and I have no reason in the world not to, and if we were to take Moshe Rabbeinu seriously, and I hope I don't have to say that again, I have no reason not to, or I'll try again. If we were to take Rashi at face value in terms of what Moshe said, Moshe is not the kind of slick-talking guy who you would suspect that he's just sweet-talking Aaron over here. When Moshe says something, Moshe means it. Moshe is saying, with all sincerity, that these two are really holier. And the reason why that's so interesting is that by the time you finish with most of the other commentaries, or for that matter, by the time you finish with a bunch of different midrashim, you end up with Nadav and Aviyu guilty of so many sins that you almost lose track of how bad they are, about all these terrible things that they've done. And the reason why that's so astounding is because Moshe Rabbeinu, according to Rashi, said, no, look how righteous they are. And that's, in fact, what the Torah is saying. And God said it black and white. Now, again, the Rashbam may not agree that God said that black and white. But what's interesting is, again, the numerous interpretations that put the blame specifically on them. And, again, see, there are hints in the text. The problem with Nadav and Avihu, and I say not them per se, the problem with constructing an interpretation is that there are many, many moving parts. We have, obviously, Parshat Shmini. Now you realize there was another section that we have to go to that talked about God's Shechina filling up the place, which happens on the day that you have the consecration, which now gave us two moving parts. The problem is there's lots of other moving parts as well, and every time you find another one, and by the way, I'll tell you right now, there's at least three others which are essential in terms of building up an understanding of what happened over here, and my very strong suspicion is that anybody who tries to create an interpretation using only one, which is right here locally, or only two, or only three, are going to end up, it's going to push it in one direction. But I think that there's five different things at least to take into consideration. And that's why the truth is I can't possibly finish what I want to do today. And I'm only going to get to one particular point within this because there's too many parts. There's just too many elements over here that each one needs to be understood independently and then need to see on how they come back and work in within the larger puzzle and ultimately let us know what's really going on over here. So again, just for example, again, just to move a little bit further, you look at source number three, which is the Sifra. And again, the advantage of a source like the Sifra, it's really quite authoritative in terms of being this Midrash Halacha. And it goes in the very same direction. This is really what seems to be where Rashi gets this from. V'yuma Moshe el Aaron, hu asher diber shem limor b'krovai ekadesh. This is what God was referring to. Zedibur nemar l'Moshe mi-Sinai. Moshe was told this all the way on Mount Sinai. He knew this would happen. V'lo yodu ad sheba ma'asav li'adav. Which means, again, this is what I hinted at before. He didn't know it until it happened. Shenemar v'nodati shem l'vnei Yisrael v'nekdash b'chvodi. Kevin sheba ma'asav li'adav, amar Moshe l'Aaron Aaron achi, lo metu b'necha el akdushat shemo. Shelakodesh baruch hu. Kevin sheyada Aaron shebanav kodesh ha'makom hein shatak. So the way this Sefer reads it is that Moshe now realizes that's what God meant, and these people are so holy. He tells Aaron they're really holy, and Aaron is silent. What can he say? He has these holy children who God took as an offering. I just want to say it like that because I think that's really what it means. On the other hand, we saw this other interpretation before from one Midrash. Now look at the Targum, which is known as the Targum Yonatan, the Pseudo-Yonatan, ascribed to Yonatan. And we'll read the Hebrew translation. You can look at the English as well. Vayoma Moshe, Hu Shediber Hashem Imi B'Sinai, which sounds the same as we were reading, Leimor, B'Shekruvim Lefanai Ani Mekadesh HaMishkan She'im Lo Nizharim Basiyat HaKorbanot. Esrafam b'shalevet ish min lefanai. Biglal sha'al ri'iti kol amet kabed. Essentially what the Targum Yonatan is saying to us, that I will be manifest, God will be there, the Shekhinah, God's presence is going to come, but if they're not hyper careful in how they do this, my fire will come out of heaven and will burn them, and then the people are going to see, what's the glory here? The people are then going to realize that having a Mishkan in a certain sense, excuse the pun, is playing with fire. Because, which means that the purpose over here is to show how serious a Mishkan is. It's something which is so intense that if somebody doesn't handle this right, it's going to blow up. But that's part of the message, which means the Targum didn't say, again, what we heard others say, oh, look, God is, because they're such tzaddikim, he's treating so strictly. He didn't say that part of it. What the Targum Yonatan says is that this place is so serious. If somebody doesn't treat it properly, there are severe consequences. And that's what's going to help establish the Mishkan as something which is so important. Look at the way that Datz Kenmi Balei Tosfot would say this. Bikrovaya Kadesh, Ayidei Mitat Krovin. Hallelu et kadesh vet gadel leinei kol ha'am sheyisu kal v'chomer ba'atzmami elu v'yishmeru atzmami lasot ken v'yiru mimeni. These things that they're going to say, hold it, if this is what happened to the sons of Aaron, then certainly this can happen to the rest of us, and we better be careful and treat this place with the proper respect and the proper dignity that it deserves, because again, this is a place that God's presence is there, and therefore, in a very literal sense, we're playing with fire. So, what's the second or the third moving part that we need to look at? And that's source number 8. And I'm not going to completely do this the way that it should be done, but it will set the stage for at least some of the interpretations. This goes back to Matan Torah. This goes back to when the Jews are standing by Mount Sinai, getting ready for Moshe to go up for 40 days and 40 nights. And part of what takes place then is that we are introduced to Nadav Avihu in a narrative, El Moshe Amar Elei El Hashem, you come up, Ata Ve'Aaron, okay, Moshe and Aaron, we're used to them going up to mountains, it already happened before, by Mechamat Amalek, but now it adds Nadav Avihu, that they're being singled out. V'shivim b'ziknei Yisrael, v'shtachvitim irachok. So therefore, Moshe, Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, and the elders. So now you just have to ask yourself one question. Why Nadav and Avihu here? Why are they being singled out? Which means their normal role that we would have sensed going from Shemot through the beginning of Vayikra till their deaths would have been people to help Aaron, to be assistants, as it were. Why are they here right now? Then Moshe himself goes up the mountain, and we're going to skip a little bit in terms of the, there is, by the way, what's very important, a mizbeach is built, an altar is built over here, offerings are brought, vayaleu olot, vayishlachet na'arei b'nei Yisrael, vayaleu olot, that may very well be, Nadav Nuyu, right, they're na'arei b'nei Yisrael, sounds like the young people, so maybe that's them, vayizvachuz v'chim shlamim la'shem parim, so therefore, maybe that's exactly why they're here. They're here to do some of the service. Moshe and Aaron are there watching, and they're doing the heavy lifting. Then Moshe takes some of, and again, continues with the offering. This is the conversion of the Jewish people. If we move to the Ramban for a second, here they say, Naseh v'nishma, they accept the offerings, they create a covenant with God, and so on. Verse 9, Vayal Moshe v'Aaron, Moshe and Aaron go up, Nadav Avihu v'shiv mizikne Yisrael. They go up the mountain. Vayiru et Elohei Yisrael, and they have an epiphany. They see something, they see God. Now, whatever this means, which means you also have a Lifnei Hashem aspect over here. V'tachat raglev k'maseh levnata sapir ka'etzem ha'shamayim l'tohar. Words which I cannot begin to translate right now, but previously when we've discussed them, I said they sound quite similar to descriptions that we find in the book of Yecheskel in the beginning in terms of a revelation. Ve'el atzine, but it says that, you know, they're there. Ve'el atzilei b'nei Yisrael, and to the nobles of the Jewish people, Lo Shalach Yado, God did not strike them. That needs to be interpreted. What do you mean God didn't strike them? It sounds very much like they deserve to be struck, but they weren't struck. Why should they deserve to be struck? But then it continues, Vayichzu et Elokim, they looked at God, Vayichlu v'yishtu, and they ate and they drank. Now some of the Midrashim compare or contrast this to Moshe. Moshe has an epiphany by the burning bush and he hides his face. They have an epiphany and they look. Moshe goes up the mountain, doesn't eat for 40 days and 40 nights, and they eat and they drink. Now, part of what may be important over here is, in fact, the drinking. Meaning, what does drink mean? What does yishtu mean? What are they drinking? Is this a celebration? Is there wine involved over here? Is there something intoxicating involved over here? Which means, is there already some type of a hint, you know, Rashi used that word before, is there another hint over here about what happened? But on top of everything else, why does it say God doesn't strike them? Because then it sounds like they deserve to be struck. One of the things that it says is that God didn't want to ruin the day. This is the day of Matan Torah. He doesn't want to ruin it. Now, that's an interesting comment, but he ruined a different day. He ruined the day that the Mishkan was built. Why ruining that day is any better than ruining this day? Which means I understand that comment, but I don't completely understand it. Okay. Let's skip a little bit because we saw most of these comments. Source number 12 is important. It's also in the Sifra. V'yikhlu b'nei Aharon Nadav Aviyu ish machtato. They each one take their pan, the machat. Afhein b'simchatan. They did this out of joy. Maybe a better word would be ecstasy. They're so, and I'm adding into this, carried away by what's taking place that day. B'nei Aharon kevan shiru chadasha sheyarda min ha-marom. When they see the fire come out of heaven and it starts to swallow up that which is on the altar, they said, let's go and do even more of this. Let's create even more of a manifestation of God being over here and God showing his love for the Jewish people by swallowing the offerings that we've offered so far, which means this would be an example of ecstasy. This would be an anti-Hasidic interpretation over here. Do not get carried away. All you want, ivdu et Hashem b'simcha, and so on, but there needs to be limits. Because look what they did. They crossed over the limits. This is telling you, you nonetheless have to be a litvak. And therefore, even when there's a celebration, there still needs to be rules. But what it's telling you over here, and that's part of what's important, is that the picture that we're getting so far, and it's going to be a little different as we continue, but the picture we're getting so far is one that they have good intentions. They want to serve God. More importantly, they want to create this more intense of a God experience. And this comes out of their joy and this comes out of their happiness. Now, they will be accused by some of being intoxicated at this point. Well, that would add to it. Once you get intoxicated, there's more joy, there's more simcha, and there's more love. But the question is how much of that is real and how much of that is artificial. And then there are boundaries which are broken. And then there's this severe reaction, which is, again, part of the problem. But when it continues over here, when it says Vayichu in Licha Ela Simcha, again it goes back that there was joy over here, which is also interesting because Likicha is Simcha. Likicha is also marriage. It's one of the things that they're accused of not being, that they have their joy here, but they don't have their joy in some other place. B'nei Aharon Nadav Aviyu Matamalon B'nei Aharon Mimashma Sha'am Nadav Aviyu Eni Odeh Sheu B'nei Aharon Ein B'nei Aharon. Of course I know they're Aaron's children. Imkein Lama Nema B'nei Aharon. Why say the children of Aharon? Lo Chalku Kavod L'Aharon. And this is very surprising. It says, because they didn't give proper honor or respect to Aharon. Because I can actually make the exact opposite argument, as I will soon. And here we go back to this whole approach and look at all the things. They didn't ask Moshe what to do. Each one did this independently. One did not discuss it with the other. Now that is a very interesting comment, and I want you to keep that in mind, because what this sifra is telling us, and I asked you that right in the beginning, are they acting together? Are they acting independently? It's saying not only acting independently, each one thought they were the only one doing it and didn't realize the other one was doing it. And once I say that, I'm going to add in another element. It's actually therefore possible that they have different motives. Because we always assume the two of them did it together. They did it together. They're the same motives. So now I'm opening up the possibility they didn't do it together. Now you see I have a sifra that supports me on that. And secondly, they may not have the same motives in terms of what it is that they're doing. Source 13 is a continuation of the sifra, Vatetzi Eish Milifnei Hashem, which understands this geographically. Melamed sheyatzta Eish mi Beit HaKodesh HaKodeshim. It came out from the Holy of Holies, v'safra to nishmatam, and it burnt their souls, which is fascinating, which means their bodies are intact, but the souls were attacked. And that's also something we need to understand. I'll see if I have time to explain this properly. It went into his nose, went into his nose. Of course, you are wondering, why are we picking on their noses? And the answer, of course, is because we're dealing with the Ketoret. And the Ketoret is incense, so therefore, of course, it will be connected to the nose. But there's something else that you may have in the back of your mind, and if you do, it's excellent. But if not, then what can I do? Source 14 we'll skip because I already said it. This is contrasts Moshe hiding his face versus Nadan and Avihu, who stare at the Shekhinah and says that's the problem. They're too brazen. Moshe has more humility. They don't. Which, again, all this is interesting because, as we saw, Rashi didn't read it that way. Vayikra Rabbah, source 15, between 15 Siman Tet and Yud, we're going to get so many attacks on them. Here we have, we're told, Rabbi Mani, Desha'av, Rabbi Yeshua, Desichlin, Rabbi Yochanan, B'Shem, Rabbi Levi, Amar B'Shil, Arba Devarim Metu. Okay, here we have four things. One, why? Shtuya Yayin, they were drunk. Because right afterwards it says, Yayin V'Shecher, I'll tell you, don't drink. Next, Mechusari Begadim, they weren't wearing the proper clothing. Now that also needs to be understood. Which clothing are they not wearing? But we'll leave that. Shenichlansu B'lo Rechit Tzirat Yadayim V'Raglayim, they didn't have the proper preparation to go in. Then we get another one, Shelo Hayulahem Banim, they didn't have children. The next one, Shelo Yulam Nashim, they weren't married. Which is actually good they didn't have children if they weren't married. It continues in Siman Yud, Rabbi Levi Omer, Shachatzim Hayu. They were arrogant people. By the way, remember a moment ago that they were holy people, holier than Moshe and Aaron? And over here, Blavy saying, no, they're arrogant. Harbei nashim hayu yoshvot agunot. Very interesting word or choice of word, agunot. There are many, agunot literally means somebody who's changed, but somebody who can't get married. Many women yoshvot agunot mamtinot lahem. Waiting for them. This is the beginning of the Shidduch crisis. These girls sitting and waiting. By the way, I think that the Shidduch crisis began with Gilligan's Island. Because afterwards every... Gilligan's Island. Afterwards every Shadchan is asked, are you interested in Marianne? Or are you interested in... what's the other one's name? I don't remember. Ginger. Ginger or Marianne? Ginger was Jewish, by the way. Are you interested in Ginger or Marianne? And then and people couldn't decide. And that's what started the Shidduch crisis. It was all because of Gilligan's Island. But over here, we see in the Medrash saying that it starts over here. We have right over here a Shidduch crisis because people are waiting. Mahayu Omrim, what did they say? Achi Avinu Melech. Our father's brother is the king. That's Moshe Rabbeinu. Achi Imenu Nasi. Our mother's brother is Nachshon Ben Aminadov. He's the head of the tribe. Avinu Kohen Gadol, our father's Kohen Gadol, v'anu shnei skanei kunan, we're second, Ezo Yisho Ganes Lanu, what girl is good enough for us? Which is a perfect way, if I read this in a class with girls, perfect way to get all of them upset with them. That's it, let them burn. What kind of people are these? But Ribbono Shel Olam, why is Rabbi Levi, by the way, it's really interesting, Rabbi Levi, right, he's Levi, why is Rabbi Levi picking on another of an Avihu, and now we have them guilty of only four sins, but you see, we're not nice to them at all. We're not going to read this entire source, but they absolutely do get picked on. Now, source 16, we're going to look at it, consider it a little bit, and then we're going to move on from it. This is Parshat Acharei Mot, Acharei Mot Shnei B'nei Aaron. And part of what happens in Acharei Mot is that, okay, Bnei Aaron are died, are dead already. Here we get introduced. Now, that I'm not being technically correct right now. We think we're being introduced to the service of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. And the thing which is interesting about it is that everything about it is remarkably similar to what Moshe, what Aaron was told to do in terms of the Chanukah Rabbayit, in terms of the consecration of the Mishkan. It's the same kinds of offerings, the same kinds of things are being done. B'zot yivo Aaron el Kodesh, b'par ben bakar l'chatat v'ayil l'olah. It's the same thing. The same procedure is being done. He's then told the clothing he needs to put on. By the way, that's very interesting because one of the things that we're told that Nadav and Avihu did wrong, they didn't put on the proper clothing. And one more thing that he's going to be told along the way, to take Torah, to take the incense and to go inside of the incense, which then leads you with this wonderful question. How wrong were Nadav and Avihu? They seem to have intuited this idea that the Ketoret needs to be a part of this process, and they take the Ketoret. Now, with all those attacks on them, part of what we don't know and is debated is, where did they do this? Did they take incense and go into the Holy of Holies? Were they doing what the Kohen Gadol does on Yom Kippur? By the way, for that matter, if the whole purpose of the Mishkan is to bring forgiveness for the Jewish people, so then you know the ultimate way of bringing forgiveness is the Avodah on Yom Kippur. There's a big argument if you're allowed to do the Avodah of Yom Kippur more than on Yom Kippur, if you could do it on other days as well. If there are other times, today, if God forbid something bad happens and people feel we need a day of prayer, in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, was the Kohen Gadol allowed to do a de facto, an ad hoc Yom Kippur service? As I said, it's a machloket. There's a Ramban that speaks about it, and it may be only the desert that was possible, maybe after the Beit HaMikdash. But as I said, their intuition over here is not as bad as you thought it was, because they're saying, "Oh, we need to take the incense, and we need to go with Sir." And by the way, think about another thing. There was no day as happy for the Jewish people as Yom Kippur. Okay, they're incredibly happy, and why? Because it's a day of forgiveness. It's a day of the Shechina. It's a day of feeling God, and they seem to feel all those things. So all that I'm saying again is, this is why I'm saying there's so many moving parts over here. We have the verse that Rashi brought in terms of the Chanukat Habayit. In terms of the Shekhinah coming down and those who honor God, or is it going to be something more ominous? And then we have this whole open question, what about those verses by Har Sinai, where it says that they eat and they drink? By the way, that's the opposite of Yom Kippur. You don't eat and you don't drink. And now you have this other part where we suddenly realize that their intuition may not have been as bad as you think. And by the way, those of you who are learning Daf Yomi, you're probably still stuck right now in the end of Shkalim. You may end it yet, have a little more to the end. When you get to the beginning of Yoma, you get to the first three, four, five pages, you're going to find something really interesting. The Yoma is going to begin with this idea of the Avodah of Yom Kippur. You need to sequester the Kohen for 7 days before, in order for him to be prepared, in order to not be involved in Tumah. And part of the question that's going to come up is, this treatment of the Kohen, Kohen Gadol, and taking him away and putting him away, where do we learn this from? And one of the suggestions that's going to be is, this is the same phenomena which is taking place in terms of Aaron's preparation, preparing for 7 days, and then Yom HaShmini. This preparation for 7 days, which means that there is going to be this whole subtext of the Gemara that the service of Yom Kippur has much more in common with the eighth day, Yom HaShmini, than you ever imagined before. And it's saying, no, these things, and as I said, once I say this, and now you're going to start learning Yom and start learning the Gemara, you say, that's what they're saying. Because, I'm going to say it one more time, this is far more connected than we realize, and that's, I'm saying, that's part of the problem. This is, again, one of these moving parts that we need to understand. But, as I said before, there's at least one other that I still want to get to. So most of this we are going to go by. Now, at the very end of Perek Tet, the following thing is described. We're not going to look inside. We're told all along the way that first Moshe tells Aaron what he needs to do, and then we find again and again that Aaron does what Moshe said. Aaron did what God commanded. Aaron did everything correctly. Aaron did a kimishpat. Everything was done properly. And then he goes and blesses the people, and then he steps down. Then something else happens. And it's so subtle. I've spoke about this a couple of years ago. It's so subtle. It's so easy to miss. Then Aaron and Moshe together go into the Ohamoid, then come out. They bless the people, and then the fire comes down. Now, what was the subtle thing which was easy to miss? Right in the beginning, Moshe said, "You do all this, God's going to appear." Aaron did all of this, and God didn't appear. Now, if you're Aaron, I don't know how you feel at that moment. If you're Aaron's kids and watching this, I suspect I do know how they felt. And then, because this whole point is that there's forgiveness. Who needs forgiveness? Well, Am Yisrael needs forgiveness. Who else needs forgiveness? Well, maybe Aaron needs forgiveness. Maybe Aaron needed to retire after all of this. He had his day as Kohen Gadol, but it was with a golden calf, and maybe that was very unfortunate. Maybe God's not really going to forgive him. Maybe he doesn't have a role as Kohen Gadol again. And Moshe says, no, you're going to be Kohen Gadol. Come and do all these things, and God's going to appear. He does all these things, and God doesn't appear. Now, as I said, it's very subtle. Why is it subtle? Because there is like this pause, and then Moshe and Aaron come out, bless the people, and the fire comes down. Everything works. Now, I noticed this. I'm not the only one who noticed it. I'm pretty sure that Nadav and Avihu, or at least one of them, noticed it. And someone else noticed it. And that's the Sifra. Again, the Medrash Halach in Source 17. Kevin Shiro b'nei Aaron shekor v'kol ha-korbanot v'nasu kol ha-ma'asim. They brought all the offerings. They did everything they needed to do. V'lo yarda shechina li-Yisrael. And it didn't come. Amar lo Nadav l'Avihu. V'chiyesh lecha adam shema v'ashel tafshiu b'lo esh. Miyad natnu esh zarav v'nechlesu l'beit kodet shechashim shenemar. Now, this is fascinating. Now, part of what's really interesting about this, and we're going to see the Rashbam in a moment, picks up on this, is that he's telling us that Nadav and Avihu act during that space and time when Aaron did everything he was supposed to do and it didn't work. And what brings the fire down? Well, then Moshe and Aaron go in together and they've come out and bless the people. And then the fire comes down. But Nadav and Avihu watch this in horror and they take fire and they bring it in. We need some kind of... So God says, listen, no problem. You know, you brought the wrong fire. I'm going to give you some of the right fire. Now, that's the way the Sifra says it. Now, and I'm not as concerned right now with the entire interpretation of this, because there are little pieces here we need to pay attention to. One, this point about Moshe saying there will be a divine response, and at least when Aaron finishes doing everything that he was supposed to do, there was no divine response. What did that cause? So I am 100% in on this in terms of Nadav Ravihu responding at that moment and bringing the fire. The Rashbam actually will tell us, and it's a long Rashbam over here in Source 18, he'll tell us that when it says the fire came down in the end of Perek Tet, and the fire comes down in the beginning of Perek Yud, in the end of Perek Tet, it was the fire that causes the Ola, the burnt offering, and Yud, it's the fire that consumes Nadav Avihu, he says it's one action. It's the same thing. Look where it's bold over here. Afkan shnei apsukim echad heim. Ukishyatza eish v'tochala ta'ola. When the fire comes down and swallows the ola v'tashlamim shal mizbeach hachitzon. Kishadachu b'nei Aaron v'krivu eish zara al mizbeach p'ni. V'tetze eish m'lefnei Hashem naktir k'torat lefnim. T'chilu paga b'nei Aaron shem u'metu. V'alkach yotza misham u'bala mizbeach hachitzon v'tochala ta'ola. So this is quite the opposite. First it consumes Nadav and Avihu, and then it continues on its way to the mizbeach. I guess if you never saw this Rashbam before, you never would have suspected that it would say such a thing. But it actually then means that who brings the fire down from heaven? You thought it was what it said at the end of the last chapter. It was Moshe and Aaron who brought it down. He said, no, Nadav and Avihu succeeded in bringing the fire down from heaven. It comes and it burns them, and then it makes a right turn, and it heads over to the Mizbeach. So, all of you who will tell me that you've learned this many, many times and you've never noticed this Rashbam before, so I hope at least that you got your money's worth for today for this Rashbam. But I think that there's one more piece which is going on over here. He also will then go, as a lot of the Balei Tosfot will then go and say, that later on in Parshat Emor, when it says that a Kohen Gadol should not leave over here in Source 19. He goes, that is really what Moshe is telling him right now. The Bechor Shor says it, the Rashbam says it, and others say this as well. Now, that was the Bechor Shor in 20. As I said, let's pause and get to the last piece that I want to get to. The Yechu B'nei Aaron, Source 21, the Bechor Shor says, Kodim She'erad Eish Min HaShamayim, right? That's the same direction as the Rashbam. So therefore now you realize, hold it, that actually would have diminished the miracle if they would have brought the fire instead of it coming out of heaven. Therefore, they force God's hand in a certain sense. The fire now had to come out of it. Now, he just now entered into a Gemara that I don't know how much we should get into. The question is, that who was supposed to bring the fire over here in terms of a halacha? Did they do something wrong or not do something wrong? But again, the larger point is they're not commanded, and I don't want to get overly complicated right now. So, what do we do? Let's move over to one more thing that we need to look at. I believe, did he actually say the words there? Give us the hint. Let's take a look. Let's take a look at the Sfarno. Now, we just saw that before, that after the Tamid is brought, right, they thought they were supposed to bring the Ktoret afterwards, which means they maybe got confused in terms of the instructions. They thought that was the proper thing to do now at this point. Now, one of the things that it's going to say, Mizbeach ha'pnimi shenema bo lo ta'alu alav ktoret, bold that for you, zara. But nonetheless, it says, don't bring a ktoret zara. Now, those of you who don't remember that term, I apologize, but let's take a look. What is a ktoret zara? And just in case you don't realize it, that's a really interesting turn of phrase when it says that Nadav Nabriyu, they bring an Esh Zara, Asher Lo Tziva, they bring a strange fire they weren't commanded to bring. So what is this Ktoret? And they light Ktoret with it. So what is this referring to? So let's look at source number 23. And now, by the time we finish with 23, you're going to realize all the, at least most of them, the moving parts. V'zer Asher Taseh Alam Mizbeach. This is what you're going to put on the altar. One second. That's not the one I wanted to do. Sorry. That's not it. No. What we wanted to see is the Ktoret, which is source number 28. That's what we wanted to see. Again, this is the place that the meeting will take place. V'hiktir alav aharon Ktoret samim. And this talks about the incense. Every day after the candles are fixed, that's when the incense is placed. By the way, notice the Lefnei Hashem. And on a daily basis, the Ktoret needs to be brought. Lo ta'alu alav, don't put on this altar of this incense altar, don't put Ktoret zara. That's the phrase I wanted you to see. That's what the Sforno told us to look at. No, nothing else should go. There are only one commanded. How commanded? What commanded? Now look at the next verse after that. And once a year, Aaron is going to bring some kind of special ktoret. Now, if you didn't notice this, I actually hinted at this before. If you never noticed this verse before, this is the first reference to Yom Kippur. In case you thought Yom Kippur was never mentioned in Sefer Shemot, it's here. Once a year, Chatat Kippurim, once a year there's something which is done over here. And what's fascinating, it comes immediately after this Ktoret Zara, immediately after the introduction of the Ktoret. Rashi writes, Ktoret Zara, what is a strange incense? Shum Ktoret Shel Nidava. It is a Ktoret which was offered, which was not commanded. The Bukhar Shor uses the same word, Ktorat Zarah, Shaloyuchlu Adam Linnadev Ktorat Lasot Alav. You can't make a donation of a Ktorat. It's something which have to be commanded to. Chizkuni Ktorat Zarah, Kol Ktorat She'eino Ba Mishel Tzibur. Any Ktorat has to be from the community, is a Ktorat, not from an individual. You cannot donate a Ktorat. Afilo Yaba Mishel Kohen Yenikra Ktorat Zarah, Kishem Shasu Nadav Aviyu, and I hope that you like that, because the same way this foreigner told you that you should look at that, over here the Chizkuni said, yeah, this is like Nadav and Avihu did, which means, once again, you find that Nadav, this is, as I'm going to say it again, it's one of the issues you need to look at in order to understand what took place over here. Look at the end of Source 32. This is the Torat Moshe. Torat Moshe is the Chtam Sofer, and I'm just going to tell you right now, the Chtam Sofer deserves a reward because he's the only one who got this right. And you know I work backwards, and I already have in my head what I'm looking for, and I get very happy when I find somebody who went in that way. Yesh lomar, shenadav aviyu yadu milota asezu, lota alu alav ktorat zara. They knew that you're not allowed to bring a ktorat which isn't offered, isn't commanded. Aval chashvu b'da'atam l'fisha b'yom ha'shmini l'miluim hikrivu g'abranam ki yom ha'kippurim. They thought that this day was like Yom Kippur. L'ficha chayam ha'krivim gam king torat yitera kimo b'yom ha'kippurim. They thought it was like Yom Kippur, and therefore you have to bring another ktorat. So therefore, they had a very good svar. And I'll say it again. I realized that this is what it had to be. I was very pleased that he got it. But I think there's actually two more issues to this. One is your homework will be to learn all of Source 33, which is a Gemara Menachot, which is quite complicated, which deals with this question about who's allowed to offer a nedava. Now, we just now saw you can't offer a gift of a ktoret, but there was one exception to this. What was the exception? Amarev Papa, if you look in the top of line, Source 33, the Gemara, again, in Menachot, Amarev Papa, b'nisiyim. We find that the nisiyim were individuals. Now, you can claim, no, a nasi, Nasi, when the Mishkan was consecrated, they brought these offerings of Ktoret. So you can say, no, they're not individuals. They represent their respective communities. This whole Gemara goes back and forth and is saying, and it ends up saying, no, Dashkan ben Nisim, Harat Shaita. No, it was a one-time exception, and therefore they were allowed to bring it. So now, with this, I'm going to pause, and I'm going to say things that were very obvious to me, that some of you may have missed, but I put it all out there. It was all, again, afterwards, you can just go like this. I can't believe I missed it. It was right there staring at you the whole time. One, every single tribe, therefore, brought a ktoret. There was one tribe that didn't, and that's the tribe of Levi. And therefore, they may very well have felt that the Nasi of Levi also has to do it. So Moshe is all of Klal Yisrael. Aaron's all of Klal Yisrael. So maybe that's their job also. They're also, just like everybody else is allowed to bring a private offering during, this is an exception, Harad Sha'ah. So this is fascinating. Why in the world are Nadav and Aviyu attacked for doing something that the Nesiim were allowed to do? Why the double standards? Now you can go back and say they're holy and everything else. I want to go back to what I understood from the Sifra. And this I didn't see anybody say. And you'll work hard, you'll find somebody who said this. Did you notice the word that kept on being used in that whole last section? There was one word, it was Nadav. You realize, of course, that one of the two sons is Nadav. And therefore, I think that the two of them had two different considerations. They each acted independently. I think Nadav sees himself as the Nasi of this tribe, and therefore he's going to bring the Ketoret, like all the other Nasiim are doing it, and therefore this is the right thing to do. Avihu, what does his name mean? Avihu, he's the one who respects his father. There is Nadav and Avihu, two different motivations. One who's bringing in Nidava, like all the other Nisiim, and that's why he's doing it. At the same time, Avihu is doing it because he just noticed, he's staring and says, look at my father. My father's being humiliated. My father had tried to bring the glory down. Nothing happened. So he goes and brings the fire in over here. And if I'm right what I'm saying, I'm just, it to me at least, it's so obvious. Look at the names, Nadav and Avihu. Those are two different elements which are connected to the story. And therefore, they're doing this for two different reasons, as we saw in the Sifra. And now I'm going to say it again. You realize this whole parsha is so much more complicated, and it wasn't easy before. And everyone's going off looking for every single sin imaginable in what they've done. And it could be, again, you go to what that Chatam Sofer said. Well, they thought this is like Yom Kippur. They have every reason to think like it's Yom Kippur because it's the same offerings being done. This is the day of creating Kapara. This is the day that the Shekhinah is returning to Israel. Maybe that makes a lot of sense. But if I, you know, move a little bit laterally and say, hold it a second. Are Nadav and Aviyah working together, or maybe Nadav and Aviyah are not working together? And if they're not working together, so maybe they have different motivations. One's bringing a Nidava, because that's who he is. And the other one's concerned about his father, because that's who he is. And therefore, Nadav and Aviyah end up both doing the same thing, but for completely different considerations. And it was very easy, and maybe very lazy of us, saying, look, they did the same thing, they had the same results, they got the same punishment, so therefore, everything is the same. Or maybe not. So I told you, it was only the last 3 minutes that I wanted to say today, but it took me the whole time to get there. So I hope at least that you found the journey interesting and are not overly upset with me for potentially wasting your time today. But I do think, even if you don't like the way that I find the minutia of every single point that I explained, I told you it's complicated. There's a lot going on over here. And, but I think the direction that I've identified is really the way to properly understand this.